Scott Colborn with Exploring Unexplained Phenomena, and it's great to have you with us. Our main guest today is Peter David Shapiro, and he's the author of two previous books, The Trail of Money, and he appeared on the show talking about ghosts on the red line, and a very interesting mystery. His current book is A Portal to the Other Side. It's a novel, The Portrait of Ignatius Jones. And Peter makes his home now in the Boston area, originally from Montreal. And he joins us from back in that Boston area. Peter, are you all dug out now from the snow?
Mostly, Scott. There's still quite a bit, but it's melting finally. Well, and some of it's melting, unfortunately, through our roofs into our house. But because we have ice dams here, but it's gradually going down.
So, how many inches did you guys get out there? How many inches did you get, Peter?
I think within about 3 weeks we had 80 inches or so, and I think Boston, which is a little bit to the east of us, has over 100, or about 100, in a month.
I know we've seen it all over the media back here, and in Nebraska, of course, we have our big snowfalls as well, but nothing like that. That's the photos and the stories on the news are just amazing, and I really feel for you guys. That's got to be hard.
Well, it's good exercise shoveling. I guess that's the good side, but it's hard to get around. Huge snowbanks in the roads and that kind of thing. But it's gradually melting. I think spring is essentially here now.
We're going to have, with all the moisture, a bountiful spring. So I know we've got listeners out in California who are still looking for moisture. They've been in a drought for several years. And too bad there isn't some way we can just ship some of that stuff out to them, Peter.
Yeah, that would make a lot of sense if there were a way to do it, because we have tons and tons of snow that would be useful for them for the water, and it's too bad we can't get it across economically. But actually, there is someone in Boston who has opened a business to sell, I think, 80-pound packages of snow. I don't know if he's got any customers, but that's what he's doing.
Wow. It's great to have you here, Peter. And tell me again, am I pronouncing the title correctly? Is it Ignatius Jones?
That's right, Portrait of Ignatius Jones. Ignatius Jones was a famous psychic medium in the late 1800s in the Boston area. And he was one of the founders of the spiritualist movement in Boston, and according to my story. And that's how you pronounce it.
So we have a character in the book that has appeared in Ghosts on the Red Line, and that is Dr. Francis, is it Gormelin?
Gormelin is how it's pronounced.
And so Dr. Gormelin is a psychic, and she featured in the novel Ghosts on the Red Line, and she's in this book as well. Give us, if you will, a little thumbnail sketch on Dr. Francis Gormelin.
Well, Dr. Gormelin was born in Boston. She came from an Italian background family, but she in the North End. Her maiden name was Masnighetti, and she grew up. Her family had a bakery in the North End, and she grew up. She knew how to. She was taught how to cook, particularly chocolate chip cookies, which she became famous for as an adult. But she grew up in the bakery, and then she was well known in the neighborhood. The North End is one of the sort of immigrant neighborhoods of Boston. There were a lot of different groups there, and she became well known for being involved with other people's activities. She was very outward going, and she helped her neighbors and so on, even as a young person, she seemed to be sensitive to them and to other things that she was hearing and passing on to them when they had troubles, and they looked up to her. And she got an education, advanced degree. She went to England, where she met her husband, who she divorced a little bit later, but his name was Gormelin, so that's how she became Francis Gormelin. She ran a children's child care center, and there was a terrible accident during one of their outings in a van, and the six little children were killed, and she survived. And at that point, she decided to change her life. She was going to follow her calling, which was to be a psychic medium, in part so that she could maintain or obtain contact with the kids who were lost and help their families, but also help others. And so that's how she became a psychic medium by profession. And she opened up an institute in downtown Boston, and she became quite well known in the city. She is, you know, one of the characters in the city, Institute for Psychical and Paranormal Research. As you said, she became involved in the Ghost on the Red Line when commuters were encountering their departed on the Red Line subway trains. And this was causing quite a disturbance in Boston, as you can imagine. And Dr. Gomelon offered her services to help out to find out what was going on. At the time, the main protagonist in the story, a management consultant named Harry West, wasn't too interested in getting her help, but she managed to force herself essentially onto into their group. And I originally had a different view of her, but I became more interested in her, and I liked her as a character, and got intrigued with her. And that's why I brought her back for a portrait of Ignatius Jones. I thought she was a very interesting person and very, very smart, very wily, very determined, and, of course, had lots of skills. And she has a major role. She's the main protagonist in Portrait of Ignatius Jones.
Peter, did you base her character on anybody that you know or that you've done research on? And you may not want to give their actual name, but is Dr. Frances Gormelon, is she based on somebody?
Well, every character has some attributes of people whom I know. But Dr. Gormelon was really a creation. She has, as I say, some attributes of people, but essentially she isn't based on anyone in particular. She's a very colorful person, as a very imaginative and very smart and very determined and very wily. Her wiliness comes out in Ghost on the Red Line, and she needs it when she gets involved in the Portrait of Ignatius Jones because she's confronting some difficult situations. But she's an invention. I hope that people think she's realistic, but she's fictional.
Mm-hmm. This is Peter David Shapiro, and his website is easily found. It's petershapiro.com.
Peter D. Shapiro.
Thank you, peterdshapiro.com. If I would have looked for my window here, I've got it right there. And so you were born in the Great White North in Montreal. What got you from Montreal to Boston?
Well, as a kid, we used to come down to Maine in some of the summers, to Algonquin, Maine, which is north of Boston. So I was quite familiar with New England. And I went to undergraduate school in Canada, several universities in Canada, then to a university in the States, and met and married a wife who was American. And we decided to move to New England, which was, you know, familiar to me. And there was a job for her and eventually for me here as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up here.
Do you retain your Canadian citizenship, or did you switch over to a U.S. citizenship?
Naturalized U.S. in 1980. So, but the way it works is you're a dual citizen unless you renounce the earlier citizenship, which in my case is Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you send a letter to Ottawa saying, I don't want to be a Canadian citizen anymore, you're always a Canadian citizen.
Well, that's great. I've often thought about moving north. I'm one of those weird polar bears that when people complain about things, it's too cold and they can't wait for the heat and humidity. I am just the opposite. I'm sort of like the snow geese. I want to go north and find some cool. So so your life twists and turns took you to Boston, and you met and married there. When did you start writing? Have you always written?
I was a management consultant for most of the time I've been here, and that's why, in fact, the protagonist of Ghost in the Red Line and The Trail of Money is a consultant, because I know a fair bit about that profession. But I started writing my first book about 7 or 8 years ago, and it took about 5 or 6 years to get to a point where I thought it was more or less done. And then I was told, then I junked it and started the second book, which is Ghost in the Red Line. and then went back and rewrote the first one, which then became Trail of Money.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's like 7 or 8 years since I've always wanted to write. I always read a lot and thought it would be a great thing to do. And in fact, in college, just after I graduated from undergraduate school, I took a typewriter to Europe. I had this image in mind of writers on their left bank and so on. I didn't have much to write about, it turns out. And so I sent the typewriter home and came back and tried to earn a living.
Mm-hmm.
Until, about, as I say, 7 or 8 years ago, I decided if I'm going to do this, time to start. So then I got to it.
And I want to ask you more about your discipline of writing and how you go about that a little bit later here. Let's give the listeners here, what we don't want to do is we don't want to go through the narrative of the book and tell the listeners, of course, the punchline or the, as it totally unfolds, but let's have a thumbnail sketch of Portrait of Ignatius Jones. What is specifically this portrait?
The portrait of Ignatius Jones, as I said, was a famous, renowned psychic medium in the late 1800s. And he had his portrait, he commissioned his portrait from a very well-known portrait painter of the time. And he invested the portrait with his aura. And he because one of the people who he was dealing with had said to him, how am I going to, at some point you're going to pass on, how will we ever live without you? And he said that there's going to be a way. So he invests the portrait with his aura, and he tells his followers that this portrait, I will communicate with you after I've passed on through this portrait, but forever. Anyone who is sensitive can reach me through this portrait. And people, are amazed at that. And he goes on and with his time with them until 1903, when he's murdered for reasons which are described in the book. And at that same day, his portrait is stolen. It disappears.
Mm-hmm.
And it reappears again 100 years later in Vermont, where at a church rummage sale. And it is purchased there by a con man named Charles Philip Tucker, who recognizes, Charles doesn't know much about art, but he can recognize something that's got some value in it. It was done by a very famous portrait painter, and it was well done and beautiful frame and everything else. So he takes this painting back to his house in Woodstock, Vermont, very nice town, and he starts to look at it, and to his surprise, after some time, he starts to hear things, and it turns out that he didn't realize this, but he's sensitive, and he begins to pick up a voice through this portrait who is, identifies himself as Ignatius Jones. And it doesn't take long for Charles to some extent, to come under the sway of the voice through the portrait, and then he starts to do things. And he has several colleagues in his various schemes, because he's been a con man for his whole life, and he's got two colleagues, Buddy Choate, who's kind of the muscle, and Marie Gaddis, who is more of an operational guy. And he brings them in to a scheme that they hatch, which is to create an income stream. It's a scheme to make money using the portrait to set up an institute of Ignatius Jones, the Center for Ignatius Jones Study, and they're going to invite people to come to see the portrait, particularly they're going to invite psychics, because they know that Ignatius Jones was famous among the community of the spiritualist community as one of the founders in the Boston area of the community, and he knows that they will pay to come and see this portrait and communicate with Ignatius Jones through the portrait. So they set up this center for psychics to come.
Mm-hmm.
That's the setup.
Yeah, we've got a number of things right there, Peter, with that brief introduction to talk about. there's a lot of people out there that are listening that have vaguely heard about the spiritualist movement, but they don't know a lot. So maybe we could start there. And let's spend about 5 minutes on that before I take the top of the hour break. If we need to, we can come back after that. But tell us a little bit about this, if you will, one of the backstories. That what was the spiritualist movement? What were people attempting to do? Is that alive and well today, et cetera?
Well, the I think actually Boston or New England is one of the centers of the spiritualist movement, where people who believe that they could communicate with the departed one way or another came together, and they were called spiritualists, and they formed, there's a community of them. In the case of the book, there's the first chapter where Ignatius Jones is talking to his followers. It's at something called the Boston Spiritualist Lyceum on Tremont Street, and this is a place where they gather to talk with other spiritualists and to have presentations from people like Ignatius Jones, who is one of their leaders. I think spiritualism has been a Boston area phenomenon since the 1800s, and I don't know how big a group it is, but it's they definitely are here and practicing what they do.
And it's probably obvious to the listener right now, Peter, that knowing that basic introduction to the spiritualist movement, that it would be perhaps a source of people that could indeed really introduce family and friends to departed loved ones through a process known as mediumship. They could really do that. But it also offered the catch-22 and also arena for con men and con women, people to come in to allege that they had these gifts and abilities, and if they would just tithe or give this donation to their group, that they could produce the result. And so I know that the famous illusionist Harry Houdini, after his wife died, he was very, very interested in this movement, and he was trying to find authentic people that could do this, at the same time exposing many people that he regarded as charlatans.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and coincidentally, he died as a result of an attack on him in Montreal, which is where
I'll be darned.
Yeah, someone came up and hit him, in a way that damaged his body, and he died from the injury.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
This is Scott Colborn with our guest Peter David Shapiro, and his website is peterdshapiro.com. He's the author of three books. He's been on the show previously talking about Ghosts on the Red Line, interesting book where people taking the subway, a specific part of the subway, would experience communication and actual visions from departed loved ones. And in fact, it got one of the Boston area people pretty concerned, who was a mobster. And he didn't want any of the people that he had dispatched showing up and talking about what he'd done. So
exactly.
As one thinks about that, there's all sorts of things that come into play there.
Of course, there are many other people who very much wanted to meet their departed, and that's
yes.
One of the reasons why the Red Line and Ghosts in the Red Line were so disruptive. Once the word got out that this was a possibility, then the subway line was swamped with
yes.
people coming in trying to have those encounters.
There appears to be evidence that if we scientifically, mechanically stimulate certain parts of the brain, that we can have peak experiences or extraordinary experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And so that may figure into. So now we're talking about Portrait of Ignatius Jones. We've set the stage, and after the top of the hour break here, We'll be back to talk about what are the spiritualists? Are they still alive and well today? And that dicey game, if you will, of who is authentic in terms of a medium, who is not, and how that all fits into perhaps the storyline here. Peter, I've got some Hawaiian coffee by my left elbow. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing fine. I've got coffee, too, as a matter of fact, sitting on Hawaiian.
Well, let's go ahead and during the break enjoy that. We'll be right back in a couple of minutes.
Okay, I'll hold on.
Peter David Shapiro, his website is Peter D. Shapiro, and you'll find more about his books and about his work. There's also a blog that he's written at peterdshapiro.com. I'm Scott Colborn with Jim Shorney and Colleen, and we're enjoying the conversation, and Colleen doesn't have a cup in front of her, but I think Jim has got some Kona blend.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful?
It's great.
I folks, am appreciative of the coffee this morning. My son left for Chicago on a Southeast High School bus trip with a bunch of choir people early this morning. So I dropped him off at about 2:15 a.m. and then went home and tried to get to sleep. And I was so worried. I got up early today because I was so worried I was going to sleep through my alarm. So,
well, I was still up at 2 a.m. actually, sitting in front of my black boxes.
We'll be right back after the top of our break with more conversation with Peter David Shapiro, Portrait of Ignatius Jones. I'm Scott Colborn, and you're listening to Exploring Unexplained Phenomena.
The Blues in Lincoln, Nebraska, KZUM Lincoln and KZUM HD. Broadcast of this program is made possible by the members of KZUM. Member support is critical to the success of the station. For information on membership, call 402-474-5086.
KZUM welcomes comments or suggestions from the listeners. If you would like to share your thoughts with us, call the station during business hours at 402-474-5086, visit kzum.org, or write to us at kzum-fm at 3534 South 48th Street, Suite 6, 68506.
Hi, I'm John Shuck, host of Religion for Life. Here's a word that's overused: God. God does this, God does that, got to believe this, God says that, got to do this, God wants you to do. You know, what does God even mean? An intelligent conversation with Val Webb, theologian and scientist and author of Stepping Out with the Sacred. Saturday afternoon at 1 on 89.3 KZUM.
The full moon lights the silver rails winding around dark mountains and over steep gorges of jagged rock and one freezing cold rushing black mountain river. I wish there was enough time to describe all of the funny twists and turns that led up to now, but there isn't enough time because there's a ticking clock and the two passengers we care most about don't know anything about it. To see what happens next, visit read.gov to read The Exquisite Corpse, a riveting adventure pieced together by John Cheska, Shannon Hale, Daniel Handler, and other popular authors. Explore new worlds. Read. Brought to you by the Library of Congress and the Ad Council.
Coming up at 12 o'clock is New Dimensions with Justine Toms. Our guest next week, the ghostess with the mostest, our guest next week is Betty Andreessen Luca and her husband Bob. We'll be talking about their UFO close encounters as detailed in The Andreessen Affair, the book by Raymond Fowler. Betty Andreessen Luca and her husband Bob Luca, our guests next week on Exploring Unexplained Phenomena. With us today is Peter David Shapiro, and the idea, Peter, of spiritualists that could contact the departed, there are many reports of that taking place that are not necessarily orchestrated per se, that somebody goes to see a qualified medium, but they're actually spontaneous. I'm thinking of the book by Judy and Bill Guggenheim called Hello from Heaven, and they've deemed it reports that came from the near-death experience, they've got, chronicled over 3,000 reports of after-death communication. Peter, are you with us?
Yeah, I am. Yes, I am. I haven't read the book. It sounds interesting. I'm not familiar with that book. But that is, of course, the premise of the story. The story came to me. Each of the books I've written sort of has come to me from some insider's thought that mm-hmm. occurred, an idea, a kernel, mm-hmm. and then it builds out of that. And in my case, this particular story came to me when I go to an art museum like the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. There are many portraits in there in the museum of people from the hundreds of years ago, mm-hmm. and these people are long gone and totally forgotten, except for their portrait that's in the museum. And in many cases, when they're well done, as they would be in a Museum of Fine Arts, the portrait is more than just an image of the person. There's personality in it, even attitude, the way they look out and stare out from the canvas. You can get a sense of the person whose image was being taken. And I was thinking, look, it feels almost like they're trying to talk to you, trying to communicate with you through this portrait that was taken hundreds of years ago, or that was made hundreds of years ago. What if they actually could? What if you could communicate with them, and you'd learn more about their lives and where they are now and where they were then, and they could communicate with you as they seem to be trying to do? And that was the kernel of the story, Portrait of Ignatius Jones. Thinking, okay, how would this come about? Well, in this case, it would be a portrait done by a famous portrait artist, and Desmond Wilkins in Boston, who the person was a psychic medium, and he would invest the portrait with his aura so that he could communicate. It would be a portal for him to communicate with his followers after he had passed on. Mm-hmm. So it's intentionally designed to be that way. And that was the basis of the story. And then I was thinking, well, what would happen if he actually did that? And what would be his personality? And what would happen to the painting? And how would it affect people who came into contact with it later? And as we find out, when it gets discovered in Vermont, it causes a lot of problems for some people. Because it's quite unusual to go to a painting and be communicated with, especially, you know, there's a few characters there who are really taken over by it.
I've enjoyed reading your book, Portrait of Ignatius Jones, this week, Peter. And I love synchronicities. I've been reading a series by Archer Mayer, mm-hmm. the Joe Gunther mystery series that are set in Vermont. And so I pick your book up and immediately find out that most of it is set in Vermont.
Right. That's right, Tudorsville, which is near to Woodstock. It's actually a mythical town, but it's based on real places, and there are real places in the story, such as Plymouth Notch, where Calvin Coolidge was born. That's still there and a very interesting place.
My good friend Dick Noble, who's a former KZUM radio station manager, is from Vermont, and mm-hmm. he touts Vermont highly whenever he has the chance, and for a good reason. It's a wonderful
place. I like Vermont a lot. It's a different kind of environment than Massachusetts or any of the other bigger states. You get a sense of quiet when you're there.
Yeah, and a sense of if I read correctly from your book and from Archer Mayer's books, of people that are very independent.
Yeah.
At some times, there's almost an isolationist feel that they're very self-reliant, pretty straightforward folks.
That's right.
That, Jim, reminds me a lot of Nebraska people right there.
Well, yes. I think there's certainly commonalities. In the winter especially, you do get cut off if you're in the smaller towns to some extent.
You know what they, Peter, you know what they say about Vermont? It's 9 months of winter and 3 months of lousy sledding.
That's funny.
And of course, all of us like maple syrup, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a big deal back there for the sugar run.
Right.
Well, Peter, you know what struck me then when you're doing this research for the book, how did you learn about then psychic mediums? Did you do a lot of research online? Did you read books? Did you, in fact, go and see a psychic medium?
I did do a lot of internet research. I started doing that, of course, when Francis Gomelon was created for Ghosts on the Red Line.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a number of years ago, and I kept up with it. And, of course, many psychic mediums now have websites. It's not just stories about them, but they have their own websites and their own histories that they put on there and the interactions that they have. And in some cases, they're videos of them talking to people. So, so it was mainly internet research. I did not go to a psychic myself, but I think I became somewhat familiar with what they're doing through this research, and not only psychics, but also people who are critical of psychics and read their stuff. And that's where that came from. It turns out I was concerned that since I did invent these characters in these situations, that actual psychic mediums might eventually read the book and come back and say this is just a poor depiction of what we do and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But that hasn't happened. Matter of fact, one person who was has been on your show read the book, and I was talked to her, and she seemed to like it, and that she said it was terrific and fascinating and everything. So I guess it comes across as a realistic depiction of what psychic mediums do and what they experience and how people deal with them.
Well, the plus or the pro side of psychic mediums being able to contact and or be contacted by departed loved ones and friends and colleagues, passing information on. I've had many guests on the show that say that they can do that. I have met some of them that I believe that have a genuine gift, that they can literally, it's not by chance, they can actually do it on command. They also have a way of apparently shutting that off, so when they're at the grocery store and somebody is quote-unquote trying to come through, they can say, just be patient, I'm shopping for groceries right now, and I'll be with you in just a little bit. That I've also met, as you've found from your research and reading the con side or the skeptical side, I found people that don't have a gift and are outright liars and hoaxers.
Yes.
That cuts across the fabric of humanity,
Right.
We don't want to paint with a large brush because we lose sight and we lose the importance of the individual. So there are good guys and bad guys. There are people that are well-intentioned and people that that make lots of mistakes and tend to include us in those. So,
right.
And we've got in the book Portrait of Ignatius Jones, we have kind of a combination of a lot of those folks. Some of the people that are portrayed in the book appear to have legitimate gifts, and some of the people in the book are obviously only out for, I would guess, Peter, the money or greed. They're out for self-aggrandizement or the wanting to be noticed, appreciated, ego fulfillment.
Right. I think there's one of the characters starts out as a con man. He's always been a con man his whole life, Charles Philip Tucker, the man who buys the painting. But he starts to hear voices, and in fact, he becomes, I think he really does become a true believer. He starts off as a con man, and the whole, but then he gets caught up in what he's doing, and he also begins, I think, to lose his mind because the village of Tudorsville, which surrounds this new center for Ignatius Jones Center for Spiritualist Discovery, they become quite alarmed at the center. It has attributes in their view of a cult, and they don't like that in the middle of their little village. So they start to be antagonistic towards it, and in return, Charles Philip Tucker and the two people who work with him, particularly Buddy Choate, his muscle, become more and more paranoid about fearing that they're going to be attacked. And that cycle of paranoia about being attacked does, in fact, move them towards becoming more of a cult.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the engine behind the story, because Frances Gormelon gets drawn in, and there's some people, or particularly people she cares about, are in danger as a result of this dynamic of hostility which has been created here.
Another thing that you just brought up again is the idea of people giving away their autonomy, either through an outside external influence that they allow themselves to be controlled and swayed by, which means that they're intellectually buying into something for some sort of fulfillment, or for more insidious ways that they are actually being possessed by or taken over or controlled by. And one of the characters that you described as being the con man who runs into this portrait and buys it, would you say that he's become possessed?
It does seem so. He certainly starts, he believes he's hearing voices telling him what to do. He's writing down what he hears into what became the book of Ignatius Jones. He does appear to believe it. And he becomes more and more convinced that it's real, and more and more determined to protect it against all dangers, all attackers, and by whatever means necessary.
Including if they believe that their work is going to be endangered, to resort to violence.
That's right. And it's not just the work being endangered, but he also, the book of Ignatius Jones starts to take on an almost a scriptural feeling for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not to be attacked or disregarded. If someone does that, if it disregards what it says, then there is someone who is utterly out of the group and has to be dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, why Dr. Frances Gormelon gets more and more involved, because this is alarming to her. She's a psychic medium. She's also a very rational, clear-thinking person, and she says, this is dangerous for people I care about, and I need to help, because she's always been a helper.
Colleen and Jim, do you remember the guests that we had on recently, Rosemary Ellen Guiley?
Yes.
And Johnny Zaffis? And their book, Haunted by the Things That You Love.
Oh, yeah. I remember that very well.
Talking about things that one may buy at a garage sale, at a antique store, that may be furniture, that may be, in this case, with Peter's book, a portrait, but that these come already charged with a... So have you, Peter, heard about the museum that Johnny Zaffis operates? It's called the Haunted Museum.
I haven't. Where is that located?
I'm drawing a blank.
I would have... Yeah, it's on the East Coast, and Johnny and Rosemary, forgive me, I can't call it up by memory.
We have to look it up.
But it's Johnny Zaffis, and it's the Haunted Museum. It should be readily found. But
that is a theme in the book, and not
yes.
only just the portrait, but also...
Yes.
Frances Gormelon in Plymouth Notch is this little idyllic tiny place where Calvin Coolidge was born, President Coolidge. And it's just a cluster of eight or nine buildings on a hill. It's beautiful, beautiful mountains around there and stuff. And she goes into an actual place, which is a barn, which has the farm implements and artifacts from mm-hmm. the farms going back 100 years or so. And in her view, she can almost, she can feel the presence of these Vermont farmers and townspeople who use them for, you know, 100 years until the 50 years or so they stop being used. And they, because they, as you said in the beginning of the show, this is very hard labor to live in the rural parts of Vermont. And it's a fundamentally a poor state, except for the tourists who've come in now. And so the folks were really extracting a living out of rocky ground. It's very difficult. And so they're using these farm implements. And when she went into the barn, she could almost feel their presence through these implements. So it's some of the same idea as you're describing there.
There's a number of paranormal investigators, Peter, that when they were talking with the individual or with the couple that are reported unusual experiences taking place, one of the questions that they would probably ask would be, you know, have you brought anything new into the house recently, such as an acquisition from an estate sale, from a place selling antiques? When the experience starts, anything in that general time frame, was there anything different that was brought in? And so Rosemary and Johnny have written the book Haunted by the Things You Love about this spirit attachment that is believed to be this energy, if you will, this construct that can ride along with some of these inanimate objects.
Well, that's, of course, exactly what happens with this portrait when it turns up.
Yep.
It before it sold in the rummage sale, it actually was hung in the Prestowitz household in Vermont, Tudorsville, Vermont, because it was found in the attic of a lady who died, and the mother-in-law of Susie Prestowitz, who ended up selling it. But before she ends up selling it, it's in her home for many years. And it's in her home because her husband, John Prestowitz, wants to keep it. And they put it in their hallway, and their little, they hang it there, and their little three-year-old daughter, Lily Prestowitz, is sort of wandering around the house, and she comes into the hallway and sees it, and she's a cheerful, bubbly little kid, and she goes absolutely nuts. And they don't know what's going on, but she's demanding that she be picked up by her father and brought up closer to it so she could touch it. She's just going crazy, and they have no idea why this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
But finally, the mother says, okay, let her touch it, for God's sake. I mean, just better touch it, see what happens. And she touches it, and she calms down immediately. So something is going on between her and the portrait, or between her and the Ignatius Jones, which is part of the story, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But so that's precisely the kind of phenomenon you're describing in this book that's Haunted by the Things You Love.
Is there anything, Peter, that is your own bias, or that comes through as an editorial in this whole thing? The communication that seems to come through the portrait, one could make the argument that it's not all light, it's not for the general upliftment. There seems to be a lot of controlling going on. And it also seems to really affect females.
Right. Well, it turns out, as the story evolves, that Ignatius Jones, although he was a renowned figure and beloved by many of his followers, he was not a perfect person.
A womanizer.
He was a womanizer. And so he had that attribute in life, and apparently he carried it on. And this is one of the things which is going on with his portrait when he's communicating through it, that he continues to communicate with little Lily Prestowitz, who grows older into a teenager, and to other women who come in contact with it, and to men. Of course, Charles Philip Tucker is a man, and he's affected by it. But Ignatius Jones is an extremely strong personality, a dominating personality. And I tried in the book, as I did in Ghost in the Red Line, not to fall on one side or the other too directly in terms of, is this really happening? I think it's more so in the Ghost in the Red Line. You could have a scientific explanation for what people are seeing, as you alluded to in the beginning, or it could be that it's really happening.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, it's more this portrait of Ignatius Jones, there's more of an impression that this is really going on. But you could read it a different way too. And I'm trying to not commit to one way or another. But I think it's important that the characters have real personalities. And Ignatius Jones has a real personality. There's a reason why he was murdered. There's a reason why his portrait was stolen. And that's consistent with what happens later when people appear to be affected by it.
The personality of Ignatius Jones is so strong, one could say egocentric, that I remember that one of the things that popped up and I said, oh, is that he was asked about, through this portrait mechanism, the communication, Ignatius was asked about God. And doesn't he come back and say something like, he could find no evidence of a supreme being?
Right. I think this is an interaction with Evelyn Billings, who is a lady of 102 years old in Woodstock. Charles Philip Tucker has formed the idea to create the Ignatius Jones Center for Spiritualist Discovery, but he doesn't have the money to fund it.
Mm-hmm.
And the word gets out that he has his portrait, however. And Evelyn Billings, who's a member of a very important family in Woodstock, hears about it. And she's gotten interested in the afterlife. She's 102 years old. But she doesn't have much time for conventional religion. She thinks it's a bunk. And she doesn't want to hear anything about that. But she does want to see this portrait. So she asks Charles to bring the portrait over to her house in Woodstock, and he does that. And in the interaction that she has generally through Charles, she asks questions about God and afterlife and so on. And that's the answer she gets, which is there's not, I don't have as much evidence of any God, but I can tell you there's an afterlife because I'm in it. Ignatius, I mean, here I am. I'm talking to you.
It was almost again, this powerful personality of Ignatius Jones doesn't want to shift the focus or attention away from himself.
Right, the world or the, again, what we call it the other side, which is described by him, is that there's the spirits of all living creatures are there. Humans and everything else that's alive has been alive once is still there in one form or another. And they do communicate with the people who are still in the physical world, but that's where they end up.
Mm-hmm. This is Peter David Shapiro. His website is peterdshapiro.com. The author of three books, including the brand new one, Portrait of Ignatius Jones. I'm Scott Colborne with Colleen and Jim. And you guys and gals out there, we are exploring unexplained phenomena. When we come back from the bottom of the hour break, Peter, talk to us about the implication in the book about when there is a need to control people and it crosses the line between just informing people and it goes into a cult, if you will. And let's talk about the nature of that, some of the telltale signs, and without, again, giving away part of the storyline, how that might figure in the book here, okay?
Okay, sure.
I'm on my third cup of Kona here, Peter, and again, enjoying the conversation with you. Thanks for taking time. And I guess I'll ask you before I go to the break, what are you going to be doing for the rest of today here? Are you indeed writing, or is this a fun day, a day off, or...
I'm still thinking about my fourth book. I'm working on the concept of it, and I haven't quite locked it down yet, so I'm bouncing ideas around. But and it's also a sunny day and not too cold, so I'll probably be outside.
I saw on your blog that you also had something working on an audiobook for Ghosts on the Red Line.
There's actually two of the books, The Ghost in the Red Line and The Trail of Money, are out as audiobooks as well as in print and ebook. They're on Audible.com or Amazon or all the places you go, iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they've been made into audiobook version. The Portrait of Ignatius Jones has not yet been made into an audio book, but the other two are.
Mm-hmm. So, well, don't let me forget now, I also want to ask you directly about how you approach writing here, because I myself am a fledgling writer. We've got lots of writers that listen to the show, and so I want to be sure and ask you that.
Sure.
Let's come back after the bottom of the hour break, and Colleen, I see you just got a cup.
Yeah, I didn't sleep at all last night.
So you're going to have some Kona Gold coffee also, huh?
Yeah.
I think we're all running a little short on sleep this morning.
Yep. But we've got some great conversation with Peter. Yeah. And you guys and gals out there, stay tuned. We're going to be right back with more conversation. It's sure great to have you out there. Thanks for your support in early February when we raised over $1,919 for listener-supported KZUM. You guys and gals, as part of the EUP family, we really appreciate you being out there and for your support. We'll be right back with Peter David Shapiro, author of Portrait of Ignatius Jones on Exploring Unexplained Phenomena.
Voice of the Blues in Lincoln, Nebraska, KZUM Lincoln and KZUM HD. Broadcast of this program is made possible by the members of KZUM. Member support is critical to the success of the station. For information on membership, call 402-474-5086.
KZUM welcomes comments or suggestions from the listeners. If you would like to share your thoughts with us, call the station during business hours at 402-474-5086, visit kzum.org, or write to us at kzum-fm at 3534 South 48th Street, Suite 6, 68506.
My name is Manny Morales. I'm 45 and I coach youth football. It's still hard to believe because the high school me
was a work in progress. But big brothers, big sisters give me a real role model. And the young me
needs a role model bad. My bigger brother's name is Ray. And Ray is the reason that this 7-year-old grows up to be a role model himself.
Whether you donate money or time, you're helping big brothers, big sisters help a child. Start something today at bigbrothersbigsisters.org. Brought to you by Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm John Shuck, host of Religion for Life. Here's a word that's overused. God. God does this, God does that, gotta believe this, God says that, gotta do this, God wants you to. You know, what does God even mean? An intelligent conversation with Val Webb, theologian and scientist and author of Stepping Out with the Sacred. Saturday afternoon at 1 on 89.3 KZUM.
And we're back with the final segment for Exploring Unexplained Phenomena. If you're enjoying the broadcast today, it's going to be archived and available by tomorrow, Sunday, 12 o'clock noon Central Time at eupradio.net. Did you guys and gals know that there's over 900 hours of recorded programs that go clear back to 2005 on eupradio.net? Well, now you do. Mike Lauver is the webmaster, and we sure appreciate his continued good work and the support we get from lots of folks. In the newsletter that I am sending out, Peter David Shapiro was on the show in the past with Ghosts on the Red Line, and I gave the fans in the newsletter the link to that free archive show. So the archive website's free charge. It's worldwide. It's eupradio.net. And, of course, if you're listening as I speak on the archive website, you already know that, don't you? So a lot of you folks can go there and enjoy Peter David Shapiro a second time and or share that information with some friends, too. So, Peter, one of the things that's raised in the book is we have the series of messages coming out through the, quote-unquote, authorized messenger. And it begins to take the form of a cult, I will just come out and say it. I mean, that would be a descriptive term that I would use. But for the listener's benefit, what is a cult? Is a cult a good thing? Is it a negative?
Well, of course, some early cults ended up becoming establishment religions, so it depends on your perspective on that.
But, right.
I think one of the attributes of a cult is that the people, particularly the leadership and their devoted followers, think they have a corner on a single truth. And it's absolutely true, and there's no legitimate or valid questioning of it. And anybody who questions it is to be driven out or somehow suppressed, because it endangers the structure and the whole notion and basically the faith that they have, that what they have is absolutely true. And if it's absolutely true, then questioning is invalid. So that's one of the attributes of it. And another is which does occur. Or it does from the point of view of the village, the people in Tudorsville in Vermont, when they see what's happening with this Ignatius Jones Center for Spiritual Discovery. The young people who are recruited to work there are instructed by management at the center not to share what's happening with the outside world, especially not with their families, to keep it secret. And this secrecy and cutting off of the followers from their families, I think, is another attribute of cult. And then a third one is, of course, when there's antagonism that forms by the surrounding community, this is felt by the people inside the group, and in return, they become extremely defensive and more paranoid that they're surrounded by enemies and they have to defend themselves by whatever means necessary, because after all, they have a corner on the absolute truth. I think that's another attribute, that there's a paranoia which develops and then cycles worse and worse.
And they point the finger outside themselves and say, that's the problem.
Right. We're about to be attacked. There's people questioning. We have a book here. In this case, it's Book of Ignatius Jones, and it's giving the truth, and anybody who is disregarding it or disrespecting it is to be suppressed, because it's just illegitimate to do that. This is true.
Cults would use disinformation. They would manage the information flow coming in and going out.
Right.
They may use things, behavior modification, such as dietary modification, sleep deprivation. There's a number of things that the cult may do to try to, quote-unquote, take control of that individual. I don't mean disrespect to some of our listeners that are tuned in, but I'm wondering that in some ways, going back to what you said about some of our earlier religions being founded, we pretty much just described the radical side of Islam right now.
I think that's true. That's also true for every major, or many major, I don't know if that'd be one, but many major religions start off with a small group of people who are intense believers, and they collect around themselves other intense believers. They exclude people who are, don't believe. And some cases they catch on and they become establishment religions, and other cases they die off.
Now we have a radicalized side of Islam, and I'm sure hoping that the moderates can have a larger voice, because I don't know of Christians right now that are beheading people and killing people and calling for a jihad or a war, but we sure hear about it from the radicalized side of Islam.
I know. Yeah. I think the Christianity went through the phase too. It just was a few hundred years ago, and there was war in it for about 100 years in Europe between Catholics and Protestants. Of course, there was a war much more recently in Ireland between Catholics and Protestants.
Yep.
So there are strains in there, I think, in major religions, as well as in minor ones, smaller ones. It just happens that this is like the time for the Islamic world to go through this. But I think most religions, or many religions, have had the same phenomenon in their history.
So one of the key points for parents listening that have children is that the quote-unquote cult will try to modify the behavior of the member through a number of ways. They'll restrict information flowing in and flowing out. They'll try to set themselves up as being the ultimate authority that would take precedence over the person's sense of common sense, of their own rationality, of what they know to be good and bad, and any authority figures that they would have known, perhaps like family. Certainly, it may extend to the sense and respect for governing bodies, that the cult tends to take that over and says, you know, the authority and the attention rests with us. They discourage people from thinking too much or talking about it, certainly asking questions. I know I'm a Presbyterian, and we Presbyterians, we would have serious problems with that, not being able to ask questions.
No, I think that's true. And one of the other things which happens in the Ignatius Stone Center for Spiritualist Discovery is that, which I think is another attribute of cult, is they make an example of people.
Yes.
who dare to contradict or in any way disrespect what they think is the truth. And in this case, it's a young a visitor, a psychic named Tessa, from Tessa Pruitt from Anchorage, Alaska. And she disregards one of the rules that's been set down. And they determine, particularly Buddy Choate, who's the muscle, along with Charles Philip Tucker, that she has to be punished publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And humiliated publicly, so that others get the message, you don't do that. You know, when there's a rule that's passed down from Ignatius Jones, you have to obey it.
Nazi Germany would be an example in our recent history of a cult.
It started off as a small group of fanatics, and of course then they got control and it became a state, a nation state, but a state government, a government of a state. So yes, the cults start small, and they seem ridiculous and extreme when they're small, but they can occasionally grow, mm-hmm, and become quite dangerous.
I think we see a lot of that in modern politics as well.
Yeah. In the case of this story, there's not enough time really for this the center and to evolve to become, you know, a major factor. The story takes place over a series of once the porch is discovered, over a couple of years, and in the latter parts of just a few months. So it doesn't have a chance to evolve into something really major. But in its small way, in a small village, in a small province, in a small state of Vermont, it has an impact.
Mm-hmm. Peter David Shapiro is our guest. His website is peterdshapiro.com, the author of three books and a fourth that is apparently in the works. That's good news. I want to ask you now about writing. There's a lot of people out there that are writers.
Including me.
And that was Colleen.
Colleen, okay.
And some people say that you write when you want to, and when you don't want to, you don't. Robert Heinlein, I think, said that he wrote because he must. Some writers have a very rigorous schedule that may include getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and writing until 10 o'clock in the morning. And no matter about the output, if it's one word or, you know, 1,000 words. If you will, Peter, tell us a little bit about how you approach writing, and let us kind of look over your shoulder maybe as how you went about writing Portrait of Ignatius Jones.
Well, the first step in writing the book, which is true for the three books I've written so far, is to have the idea, the kernel of the idea, which I mentioned was, in my case, staring at and studying portraits in art museums,
mm-hmm,
and thinking about it. Well, but once you have the kernel of the idea, then different writers have different approaches. I know that J.K. Rowling, the Harry Potter author, and she's written some very good books after that as well, she apparently then famously outlined the stories for the 7 volumes of Harry Potter stories in advance. She knew exactly where it was going to go, and then she filled it in over a number of years. I don't do it that way. Maybe I just don't have the imagination or discipline or whatever, but the way I do it is I start with the kernel of the idea, it has to be a good idea. It has enough heft to it, or you know, resonance to survive this process. But start with that, and just start writing with the characters. And as we get to each junction in the story, there's a logical decision to be made, or a narrative decision to be made. Would they do this, or would they do that? And what would be the issues they'd face, and how would they deal with these issues? So I sort of progress through the story. I don't really know when I started how it's going to end. I know basically what it's about.
It's an adventure for you, too. It's an adventure for you, too, Peter.
It is. And it takes, obviously, some period of time. Once I'm involved in it, then it's involving, and I write every day. But I have a very, short attention span also, unfortunately. I'm up here with my computer on, and there's lots of other stuff, there's news to see and this and that. So I get distracted easily, but the story is demanding to be pursued and see what's going to happen each step of the way. And finally, when we get to the end of the book, I know when I'm sort of at the end. I've got a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that's, in a way, the first stage. Then I go back and revise it over and over and over and over again. Sometimes this involves cutting out chapters, creating new chapters. There's a gap. How did this happen? Well, I got to, this happened because of such and so. I mean, for example, with Portrait of Ignatius Jones, I don't even know if you recall the scene, but little Lily Prestowitz, the daughter, is off working in Block Island, which is a resort off the coast of New England, and it's while she's away for the summer that her mother, Susie Prestowitz, decides to sell the painting at this rummage sale. It's convenient because Lily's very tied up with the painting, and she would complain if she were home when her mother decides to sell it. So it's a convenient moment. She's away, and that's when the rummage sale happens. Well, I had a whole scene or a chapter of Lily down in Block Island with her friends and working there and thinking about back in Vermont and everything else. And that whole chapter was created in the later stages of the book. It wasn't there in the beginning, but I felt that there needed to be a place for Lily, just to get to know Lily a bit better and to learn more about her feelings about the portrait and about, her life in Tudorsville. And that's how I created that. And also there were many chapters which I had which were cut out, just had to be deleted because they didn't forward the narrative sufficiently.
We're talking with Peter David Shapiro. PeterDShapiro.com is his website. And so, Peter, do you have a set time every day that you write?
Basically after breakfast until late afternoon. I'm not one of the folks who gets up. I take a walk every morning, and by late afternoon, I also play the flute and stuff like that. So I got other things to do. So I start after breakfast, like around 10 o'clock, and we'll go to 4:30 or so.
Mm-hmm.
Every day, and some days I'm more productive than others. There'll be times, and currently is a time with my fourth book, which I'm still trying to work out what the idea is. And I have the kernel of the idea. It's about someone who disappears, not disappears right in front of you, but whose car is found in a ravine and nobody knows where he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
That's the beginning of it, but I'm not really sure. So I'm still working out where do I go with it. And in the middle of the other books, like Portrait of Ignatius Jones or Ghost in the Red Line or Trail of Money, there are many times in the narrative where I come up on a wall. And it takes a fair bit of thought to figure out what happens next. For example, with Ghost in the Red Line, the main protagonist, Harry West, who's a consultant, does determine for his client, which is the operator of the transit system, which operates the Red Line, he does, as he's asked to do, find out why. He finds out how it is that people are encountering their departed. He determines the cause. He doesn't know whether it's real or not, but he knows why it's happening. So I got to that point in the book, and it wasn't satisfying to me to just stop there and say, okay, he discovered the answer, and so be it. The MBTA deals with it. And that's when I came up with this notion of, well, what would happen if there's so many people who want to keep encountering their departed, and the red line, the MBTA is going to shut this down on the red line, so what are they going to do? So it happens that one of the people who really is interested in meeting her departed is his ex-wife, Alexandra. because their child was killed as a young child by a drunk driver. So she's an entrepreneur, a very, very, very smart person here in Boston, and she comes up with the notion of visitation rooms where they would recreate the attributes of the Red Line train cars in these rooms so that people could come to the room and still continue to meet their departed in these rooms. And that was the second half of the book, the creation of the visitation rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And all that would happen there were, you know, the gangster who we met earlier in the story is not too pleased about it because he doesn't want the people who he's buried in parking lots all over Somerville coming back and pointing their fingers at him.
Oh.
So he's opposed to that, as is the church and some others.
Peter, do you like to use the mechanism of the computer for a word processor, or do you like pencil and paper, legal pads?
It's all on the computer. I was fortunate to have a week off of this horrific winter we've had here down in Key West in early February, where Hemingway lived for a while. And Hemingway wrote on a typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how, you know, because he's a brilliant writer, but I just don't know how people did it back then, because at least with my style, I revised many times. I'm talking 20 or 30 runs through the book, adding chapters, dropping chapters, changing wording in almost every sentence. You know, you couldn't do that without a computer. I don't know how people managed, at least my style. Maybe what they did was they wrote much more perfect sentences and perfect narratives to start with. But that's not my thing. I want to get to the end. Once I get to the end, I know I have a story. And then I can go back and improve it.
And fine-tune it,
right. Refine it, fine-tune it. But the major thing is to get to a conclusion that ties it together so that there's now a real thing to work on. In that way, it's a little similar, I think, to paintings. And that's maybe another reason why both my mother and my brother are painters. It's like doing an oil painting. You rough it out in the beginning, and then you improve it and touch and dab and refine and, you know, make changes. And that's sort of the way I do a book. I do the basic roughing out to get to the end of it to have the basic picture, and then I refine it.
Next question. Where does the position or the function of an editor come in? Mark Twain hated editors. Many contemporary writers appreciate editors because it makes for a better book.
Well, I think the editors are very important. I hired an editor for The Trail of Money, and the same editor again for Portrait of Ignatius Jones. And what he did in both cases was not what they call substantive editing. That is, he was looking for the coherence of the story,
mm-hmm.
the credibility of the characters, the logic of the narrative, you know, and also, you know, what could be lost and what needed to be added. And so he read it for that. He read the early draft for that, and he said, you need more here, and this is unnecessary, and I suggest you cut that. And that's the function. And it was very important to have that. He really did help. And actually, I had a similar help for Ghost in the Red Line, but not from a paid editor. It was a literary agent who very kindly gave me back several pages of written comments about the logic of it and this, you know, need to do this and need to do that. So that's, I think that's really critical to do that. And unfortunately, it's also somewhat expensive, but it's an investment I think you have to make.
Yeah, there's a lot of cost on your part as a writer just to try to see this thing into fruition.
It's true. The major costs are the big lump of cost is the editor, and then there's a fair bit of cost in the back end for getting the word out about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's marketing of tools of various kinds, but they're not free. So, for Ghost in the Red Line, I actually I had a poster produced and ran in the Ghost in the Red Line trains. You know, I advertised it.
I'll be darned.
Trains. And so there was something like 75 of the train cars for 6 weeks. There were posters of Ghost in the Red Line, which I thought was kind of like a meta message. You know,
mm-hmm.
these are people riding on the Red Line, and they're reading about Ghost in the Red Line, and there's a picture of a Red Line train on the cover. So I thought that was kind of clever, and it did get a lot of attention. But that cost a lot of money. The MBTA doesn't sell those poster spots for nothing.
Mm-hmm. So the the paranormal, if you will, large umbrella term, figured into Ghosts on the Red Line and also Portrait of Ignatius Jones. Is that an area of interest that reflects your own personal interest? And have you had, all of about 2 minutes worth, have you had some personal extraordinary experiences, Peter?
It's an area of interest to write about it. I haven't, the only experience I've had that I'm, you know, is actually the basis of this new, the fourth book which I'm writing, which I don't think is going to be about the paranormal, but it's about a disappearance. And that was a friend of mine who I'd been in college with, in fact, was in a circumstance where he was, his car was found, he was gone, nobody knew what happened to him. I dreamt about him and thought about him, and, you know, I thought he was dead.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 7 or 8 years later, I was in a restaurant in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I saw him. He was a waiter. I thought, like Ghost in the Red Line, this is the ghost, but I went up to him, and he was a physical person. And he had just decided that he wanted to have a different life, and so that's why he took off. And he was having a different kind of life, he was around for another year or two before he disappeared again. So that was the closest I've had. I'm interested in it, certainly enough to write about it.
You know, we had a gentleman, maybe Jim remembers this, that was a weather forecaster for an Omaha, Nebraska TV station. His name was Fritz. And he was there for a number of years, and somebody traveling through the area happened to watch the weather forecast and saw him and realized that he was somebody that they knew, apparently, from, I'm going to guess or remember, the West Coast. And he'd apparently had some sort of a injury and an amnesia and had to sort of start over. And didn't know anything about his earlier life.
I hadn't heard that story.
Well, during the research on this latest book, it turns out there are a very large number of people who are missing right now. I mean, many of them are young people who have run away or whatever, but it's astounding. We live in a very large country, but there's just hundreds of thousands of people who are missing at any given time. So it's a fairly common phenomenon.
I have some suspicions about that, but we are out of time here. Peter, thank you so much for the gift that you give us through your writing. And once again, as I did for Ghosts on the Red Line, I've enjoyed reading Portrait of Ignatius Jones, and I sure wish you well with future projects.
Thank you very much, Scott. I appreciate it.
Our guest today is Peter David Shapiro. His website is peterdshapiro.com. He also has a blog there. You'll find more information about his books. Paranormal Mystery Thrillers would be a good term for those two books, Ghosts on the Red Line and also Portrait of Ignatius Jones. Next week is Betty Andreessen Luca and her husband Bob Luca, the folks featured in The Andreessen Affair by Raymond Fowler. We're talking about UFO close encounters, and maybe some stuff like government harassment, perhaps the Men in Black.
No.
Should be interesting.
There's
folks.
No such thing.
We've got a great spring and summer programs that are in the works. I hope you stay tuned. Thank you all for listening out there, and we sure appreciate your support. Jim, Colleen, thank you very much for coming down today.
Thank you, Scott.
Yep, being part of the broadcast. Folks, stay tuned for New Dimensions coming up right now. Until next week, I'm Scott Colborne and Walk in Beauty.